Hi, and welcome to All Policy is Local, the podcast where we go beyond the headlines and give you a seat at the table for some of the most important public policy conversations facing Seattle today. All right, well, here we are with Chief Librarian Faye of the Seattle Public Library. So why don't we go ahead and start just by you introducing yourself and your journey that led you to being in charge of the Seattle Public Library, and then let's pivot to talking a bit about the library itself.
Great. Thank you, Council Member, for inviting me. My name is Tom Fay. I'm the Chief Librarian. I've been in the role for about 2 years, both as the interim and as the permanent Chief Librarian. I've been in Seattle about 8 years. My former position at the library was Director of Library Programs and Services, and that's really everything that you see public-facing, branches, the central library, the collections, IT, so all the computers you might use or technologies. And prior to that, I spent about 32 years in Nevada libraries and retired out of the state of Nevada before moving up to Seattle.
Yeah. Well, we are really happy to have you here leading this really important institution that's very near and dear to the hearts of all of us at the Seattle City Council. The other day, I almost told somebody, I was like, oh, yeah, no, Chief Librarian Faye is great. I presided over their confirmation. And then I realized, wait a minute. No, like he just comes to committee a lot. We don't appoint the Chief Librarian. The Library Board does, although we have appointed a number of really outstanding Library Board members to work with you. Why don't you talk a little bit about the structure of the library? Like how big is the footprint of our Seattle Public Library? What's the diversity of programs and services that you offer? And then we can dig into a couple of those.
Absolutely. Obviously, as you mentioned, we're a little bit different in city government in that we're both a creature of the state and of city charter. We're not an executive department, meaning we don't actually report to the mayor directly, nor to the council. Our board of trustees actually has all fiduciary and policy setting powers, and also have the authority to hire the chief librarian. But we have a great relationship with the city of Seattle. Obviously, the council and the mayor provide our general fund budget and our authorization to do levies, which is critically important for the services that we bring to the citizens of Seattle. We have 27 locations spread across the city. For sure, Seattle is very much a neighborhood-oriented city, and our branches sit in those neighborhoods. We have the Central Library downtown, and our mobile services that people often don't know as much about or think about unless they go to those services stop in over 100 locations every month. And so we've got a pretty big footprint all over the city, and we are obviously the city's largest referral service for information needs.
Can we talk a little bit more about those mobile services? Because I agree. I think that might be one of the things that passes a lot of Seattle residents by in terms of services they associate with the library. What kind of services does the library provide on a mobile basis, and how can people access those? And how does the library decide how to deploy them?
Absolutely. So we have a variety of them. For the most part, people think of their bookmobiles. Many people may have grown up in areas of the country or even here in the Seattle area and have a fondness and a memory of those bookmobiles. We have those vehicles, but we also have Sprinter vans that are delivering to older adult assisted living centers. We also have that same type of service that might be at a daycare facility. And really what we look at is we really take a race and social justice and equity lens approach to how we have these types of services, which are obviously very expensive as you're trying to move throughout the city with these large vehicles or even smaller vehicles, and really trying to prioritize those audiences most at need. So that's how we go about selecting those stops and looking for community partners that are willing to have those vehicles or those services in their locations. It also includes other services like our Leap Lab at the Central Library, which is for our patrons who may have disabilities, who need additional assistance. And it could be books that we mail to your home for folks who are not able to get into the library in any way. Those are all services that are out there that people just don't know about. They can always contact us and go to spl.org to learn more. It's the best way, and there's a variety of ways to contact us there through chat, email, or phone.
Tell us more about the Leap Lab.
So it has a lot of different technologies to help people that maybe they have vision issues, they may be blind, those who are deaf as well. So services to help folks, it may be to get information services, it may be something as simple as a document that they need to have loaded in so it is read to them. There are a number of technologies and staff there to assist folks as they come in.
And that's at the University of Washington?
No, that's at the Central Library.
Oh, sorry. I misheard earlier. Yeah.
But we are actually working with the University of Washington for maybe what the next generation of these services look like as we do our strategic planning.
Yeah. So we're going now into the summer months. And I remember growing up in Seattle in the Crown Hill neighborhood, my local branch was the Greenwood Library on the same site as the new Greenwood Library. Mm-hmm. But it was the old one is the one that I have the fond memories of. And I can still recollect the layout of that library, although it's long gone because I spent a lot of time there. That was the first place that I used a computer and became computer literate when I was a very young person. I think the computer station at the library was, you know, was like one computer in the early 90s. But that was the place that I first got exposed to, you know, that omnipresent technology, obviously, in today's workplace. Why don't we talk a little bit about going into the summer months here and some of the programming that is offered in the summer by the Seattle Public Library, leading with that more at the front of the podcast. So people can take full advantage of those things.
Absolutely. Well, one of the fun ones that I enjoy every year, especially for adults, is our book bingo. It's a great way to kind of stretch your reading. I know we all kind of get in our safe zones or ruts when it comes to reading. This is a way for you to really kind of open up your eyes to some other genres, maybe some other subjects that are out there. And it's just a fun way. Everybody knows generally how to play bingo. If not, we have some instructions on how to do that. But you select your path to creating a bingo. Some people really get into it. Those avid readers might actually try to do a blackout of the bingo card during the summer. But I think most people just have a lot of fun trying new material to read. The other item that we, or the other services.
Well, before we go on from
sure,
book bingo,
sure.
There's prizes, right?
There are prizes.
So say that a little. Don't bury the lead in book bingo, okay?
I think it's always interesting. There are those who go for the prizes, and then there are those who go for the glory. And that's in their special book groups or friends, colleagues. So it's a little bit of both. For many, it's more the glory than the prize. But yes, there are prizes as well. And you can see that on our website that's associated with the book bingo card.
Great. But prizes and glory. So we've established that for participating in book bingo. Okay. Sorry. The next cool thing we're doing this summer at the library.
The next thing is one that we've actually done for 104 years, which is our Summer of Learning program. This is the 104th year of this particular program, and this is really for youth and focused on really that STEAM learning during the summer. We know that there is a lot of loss between summer and starting of school again. It's hard to believe that we're already moving into July and school's not out, but it is ending soon. And in those couple of months, there can be loss of progress in reading. There can be loss in progress in any of the subjects covered in school, including math, et cetera. So our program really focuses on reading, obviously, as an aspect of it, but also those STEAM elements around the sciences, mathematics, even arts, just to tie in all of those elements to keep the brain stimulated during the summer and not just maybe sitting at home on a gaming system or something that may be not stimulating the brain in all of its modalities.
Yeah. And to be clear, the STEAM acronym you used earlier, science, technology. God, what is the E?
Engineering, sorry.
It's got to be engineering, arts and math.
Just to
make sure. People might have heard STEAM and been like, STEAM, what? So
the acronyms always kill us.
Yeah. Great. So why don't we pivot to some of the other stuff that the library has been doing? And there's been a lot of coverage recently of the Seattle Public Library's engagement nationally on access to banned material as a part of the library's mission. Seattle Public Library and the Brooklyn Library, I think, are the two founding institutions driving this movement. Why don't you talk a little bit more about how this is going, you know, what motivated the library to be an early adapter? What was the path to even start this effort? And then let's talk a little bit more about the programming.
Yeah, it really what we saw and what our colleagues are seeing across the country is that last year there were over 2,500 titles that were censored or banned across the country. It's the largest number ever, at least recorded by ALA. It was a 38% increase over the year before. And most of these bans or censorship issues were related to LGBTQ plus titles, authors, subjects, as well as BIPOC authors and subjects. And as we've seen this, these have grown to be very coordinated and well-funded efforts. And as we looked at it, you know, instead of sitting there and saying, let's just make a statement, which is in a city like Seattle, which is high in readership, highly educated, it would just be a statement, obviously supported by the people here. So as we talked about it internally and really talked to our colleagues in Brooklyn, worked with our foundation who privately fund this effort, we felt that to really make a difference was to provide this material to people across the country who are being denied access to information, but also being denied access to knowing. We think about information as just a thing, a commodity, but you know, to even know about something, it's pretty scary when, you know, maybe a paper in your hometown isn't talking about it. Maybe it's completely banned from your school.
Maybe you don't even have a paper in your hometown anymore, given the erosion of, I mean, related issue, but different.
Exactly.
Right. But anyway, continue. Yeah.
So when we looked at it, we said we can actually work with the Brooklyn model. You know, one of the things I've seen in my career is often everybody goes along and tries to do their own marketing campaign or own version of it. And I said, let's not do that. Let's really join together with Brooklyn. Let's make this a kind of a national look and feel. Hopefully others will join. We know others are thinking about it. And let's be under one banner so that, again, we are pitching this from a national level of libraries saying, hey, this is enough on the censorship side. We have the ability to deliver material to people anywhere through e-books, e-audiobooks, and that's exactly what we're doing. So if you're age 13 through 26 anywhere in the country and the U.S. territories, you have access to all of our titles, which are extensive, as well as Brooklyn's.
Yeah, so how does that work? Let's say, you know, I'm in one of these jurisdictions. You know, I hear about this effort somehow. I go online to the Seattle Public Library website. And do I apply for a library card just like any other person in the region? Or is there sort of a special like portal that people go to?
It's a special card and it's a special portal. It's spl.org/booksunbanned. And it is for people that do not live in King County or Seattle. Obviously, if you live in King County or Seattle, you can apply for a normal library card and have all the services. But it is an electronic access card only. So it is really intended for people to access those e-materials that we have available. And it's a pretty simple sign up. We do ask for some basic information. We also ask people are willing to provide why you have the need or why this is important to you. We've gotten some very both heart-wrenching reasons for it, as well as just some of the things that maybe you didn't anticipate. People living out in rural areas that are 75 to 100 miles from a town that might even have a library. So it has been very interesting to see the different types of reasons that people are needing this service. And we've had well over 3,000 people sign up here just in the last couple of months.
Yeah, from all over the country.
All over the country and those territories, Puerto Rico being one of those.
Do we have any assessment of how many states and territories are represented in that? Is it someone from almost everywhere?
It is every U.S. state.
Every U.S. state.
And Puerto Rico is the one territory, at least right now. And I think I saw something with Guam, but I'm uncertain. Mm. I think that one also came through.
That was going to be my next question. Is Guam the holdout here? But I guess no one yet from American Samoa.
Not yet. Doesn't mean that we won't see it, though. We are really, when you think about it, pretty early into this with only 2 months. Our colleagues in Brooklyn have been doing this almost a year. Hmm. So they've got a little more traction on it, but we've seen some, it's an incredible amount of people signing up in 2 months.
You referenced that you also got some heart-wrenching anecdotes. Anything that you can share anonymously here?
Yeah. I mean, I have one here that was from a person who said, I'll be able to access and read books without having to go out. I'm physically disabled, age 18. That came from Arizona. I'm a queer trans man who can't pay off the fines of my local library card from way back when I was a kid, age 19, in Pennsylvania. I can't get to my local library often because it's not that close to where we live and I don't drive yet, age 13, Delaware. I'm not eligible to get a library card in my city because I live outside the city limits. That means I currently can't check out any library books at all. So getting access to ebooks and audiobooks is very exciting for me, age 23, Texas. So as you can see, those are just some of them. I mean, there are others that I probably wouldn't share because they're very personal in nature. But yes, we've seen a lot of folks who are in fear of checking it out, that family members know or somebody in their town might know the material that they're checking out to better understand themselves and better understand their life's journey.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing work. I'm so proud of the Seattle Public Library for doing that and for stepping up and being a national trendsetter in this. You indicated there's other libraries that are thinking about joining this effort. Is there going to be an effort to really stitch this together into a collective of the libraries doing it rather than a bunch of one-off efforts? Because that would be very powerful to have like a league of libraries that are engaging in this practice and making their collections available instead of just a bunch of isolated examples of that courage. Like, it'd be great if there was one repository where you could see the whole list, mm-hmm. right? Of like, these are the libraries on the front edge of expanding access to information and, you know, pushing back on the banning of material.
I'm hoping so. I've been talking to colleagues coast to coast, would love to have some more in the middle of the country. We know likely there's a couple more coming on potentially in the fall. I won't steal their thunder at this point, but we know that there's a couple in the middle of the country that are considering that. And hopefully we'll be able to get a few more. It's not as easy as people might think. We're very fortunate here in Seattle to have, we actually have the largest public library foundation in the country. Mm-hmm. And that is a great asset. They've been a great partner and collaborator in working through this because our main goal is we want to make sure the taxpayers in Seattle have availability and access to this material and that this would not impact them. So our private foundation and funder is actually taking all of this on. And, you know, they're out getting donations that they've been very successful in doing that already. But not everybody has that. I just attended their International Foundation for Public Libraries, actually started by our Seattle Public Library Foundation 6 years ago. And, you know, people are all over the place in public libraries. Some have foundations, some might have friends groups, some have nothing. They're starting from scratch. And so we know that for our colleagues across the country, this is twofold. It's both the private funding and the advocacy needed, you know, the support that you would need to do this. There are parts of the country that this might be dangerous to do and might be something that could bring a library system down. We've seen libraries in this last year completely defunded by their town, by their citizenry because of material that was in it. So it is a very trying time for library directors, library boards, and library staff.
Yeah. I mean, and it makes the work for library systems like ours all the more intense in filling that void to provide the services we take for granted. I mean, it's remarkable how much of a role the Seattle Public Library plays in our civic life that I don't think it's always acknowledged by everybody. I do think to a certain extent we do take it for granted, and there's nothing that puts that in stark reality more than seeing cities and towns that lose that library and the void that's left after that.
Well, so. And some of the efforts, you know, in some states now, just one state over from us, even in Idaho, looking to actually criminalize having this material available, meaning librarians can be fined or go to jail if they have this material in their library. This is now in more than one state. This is probably in about 7 or 8 states that legislatures are approving these types of laws, making it a crime for librarians to actually provide these materials.
Yeah, no, it's a very scary time, but thank you for your leadership and pushing back on that. Moving to another topic, Seattle Public Library during COVID, coming out of the most recent calamity, had some innovative ways to continue to connect with people during the pandemic. It was a time where all of us struggled to attempt to maintain basic city services, and access to the library collection is definitely one of those things. Was pretty good at innovating to fill that void and to step in. I don't know if you want to highlight any of those efforts, and that was during your interim period.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was actually, even before that, leading the reopening efforts. It was obviously one of our most challenging times as a city, but obviously as a nation. And I think the one thing we know in all of this, and I believe we've all learned this and know this now, is that none of us were anywhere near as prepared as we needed to be for such a catastrophe. Our most marginalized citizens disproportionately felt this. That means, it could have been homeless, insecurely housed, BIPOC people in various areas of the city. And we know as a library that we were not able to meet all of the needs that were out there. So we acknowledge that. But we know that we were able to also turn things around in some cases very quickly, moving our staff to be able to do their work from home, which meant that we could bring on information services once again. Again, you'd have to call in, you'd have to use email or chat services, but we were able to do some of those things early on in the pandemic. And even simple things that we were able to do, although scary for a lot of staff, myself included, as we were planning it, bringing on hygiene centers in the sense of being able to have restrooms open for people across the city. That didn't happen everywhere. The city, when I think about the library, we did some really good things initially. When I look at some of the things that we see as benefits of it, it would be that we now know that we can do more in the electronic realm with video and using tools like Zoom and WebEx and all these other technologies to actually allow our programs to be seen by more people. A lot of people don't want to come downtown. It's sometimes hard to get there. Maybe they don't have the means to get downtown. We're now able to expand the programming so people can see it by having it available online, which was something we just were not doing to any large degree before the pandemic. So we made a lot of improvements there. The one thing it taught us as well, and we continue to build on that now, is really improving our internal infrastructure and technologies. We've got to have better networks. We have to have better equipment to make sure that we're really supporting this. But it really highlighted our need to even reach out more to our partners to find out who's still there, who's still struggling, because a lot of partners went under. And partners are really how we did our work prior to the pandemic. And as we come out of it, we want to continue to do more. So in our strategic planning and our foresight processes that we're looking at for strategic planning, it's really reaching out to those partners again, from an equity and RSJ, race and social justice perspective, to have them participate in this process and to let us know what are those new needs in the community, and really listen and not be assuming what we think the library might bring, but hear what those needs are. So those are just a few of the pieces we've been bringing online here in the last few months as we do more planning.
That might be a good pivot to talk about the role that the library plays, that sort of evolved organically out of necessity, because a lot of our neighbors experiencing homelessness don't have places that they can go to access a computer, to access hygiene services or hygiene facilities, I should say, to access information that they might not have access to, you know, private collections or their own collection of books, but the library that belongs to all of us is a place where they can access those services. But over the years, obviously, that's become a much bigger part of the what the library has had to deal with. And I think under your leadership, the library has taken on that part of the mission much more explicitly to try to figure out ways to be a better host to a lot of people in our community who have significant challenges and are experiencing homelessness. And I wonder if you want to highlight a couple of those initiatives and some of the things the library has been doing, just based on that reality of how it intersects with your work.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that a lot of people, you know, we're fortunate enough and privileged enough that we may not have a lot of need of various services that are out there. But the library is truly the last place in this city or pretty much any city that is free. People can just simply be, and there's not a cost of entry of any kind, meaning you buy a drink, you have to buy something to sit somewhere. It's a huge piece of what we do. So we know we're that important place for people. But when we look at some of the work we've been doing with our social services, we restructured a lot of that after the pandemic. What we of course, have social workers to assist us and our patrons as we move through challenging times, either with their health, mental health, homelessness, and any other number of addiction issues, et cetera, that might come into play. But we really restructured it so that we also have a social services librarian who then takes the information from those social workers about all the referrals and all the resources that are out there. And of course, they're all networked with the city's social workers and others in the field, and lets our actual librarians also know, and our library staff, so that when somebody comes up to a desk at a branch, they probably don't have the social worker there, but that librarian knows all those same referrals that they can send people to. And we have people come to us all the time that might need housing, that might need mental health services or addiction services, and we're able to do that. And it is part of the library's role. We are a referral agency, and we're the biggest one in the city. So we take that role, and we take pride in that role. And this allows us, by restructuring in this way, to provide these services from a full professional social worker's perspective, so that we're not leaving any referral opportunities off the table. And that's just one way that we've worked on it from those perspectives. When we look at our race and social justice and equity approach, that's, again, been a big piece of what we want to do as we reach out, as we go through this planning. We recently put out a new equity statement that's available at spl.org/equity. It is something we hadn't done before as an entity, saying, what is it? What does it mean to us? Why do we do this? Why do we take this approach? People ask us as we make these choices about the types of services and who we serve, prioritizing certain audiences. So that information is available. We also are being more transparent about what are we doing? Where do we run into roadblocks in our race and social justice and equity efforts? So those are things that we're still working on and developing to create that transparency with our communities.
Yeah. Well, it's really important work. And, you know, I really appreciate the diligence and the service of everyone who works at the Seattle Public Library. I mean, I've witnessed on a number of occasions just, you know, really special acts of kindness on the part of library employees doing things that are not generally in their job description, but doing it because they want to help a patron who's in crisis. And, you know, I know that work will continue and that they take that work on. So
they do. We save lives in many ways, sometimes physically and sometimes spiritually and mentally, depending on what the person needs. I'm proud of the team and the work they do.
Yeah. So why don't we close just by asking what's next? What are some things you're particularly excited about that are on the horizon for the Seattle Public Library and things that people might expect to see that that takes this programming and this institution to another level?
Hey, for me, I think trying to wrap up our engagement around our planning, we know that there's, you know, additional programming we can do in the community when we make those connections. We also know that our buildings are going to need to have some pretty major improvements. When we look at moving this library to be a mid-century library, kind of scary to think that that's what we're thinking about and planning for. But realistically, as we sit here in 2023, the efforts we're going to make in the next levy, efforts that we're going to make in capital improvements in these buildings are really going to move us to mid-century and what people are going to need for a generation that's probably not even born yet. But we have to start thinking about what some of those needs are going to be. Creating flexible spaces, adaptable spaces in our buildings that we can do everything from the do-it-yourself programs and however and whatever those technologies might be, to really being able to bring in any type of cultural amenity that we want to bring into those spaces. These buildings are going to need those changes. The Central Library is 20 years old next year.
Wow.
And has not had any major capital improvements done to the interiors. We know that all of those infrastructure things are going to be there, air conditioning, carpet, all those things we have to continue to replace. But what do we want these spaces to be? That's why we're engaging with our communities now. And that's really the exciting part, because for so long during the pandemic, we were all shut off from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. One question I have about that, to what extent do we need to decarbonize our libraries? I imagine some locations are probably decarbonized. I imagine some have not been updated for decades and probably are very much in need. But I'd be very curious if we start looking at a capital improvement program, you know, the nexus with decarbonization, with making certain sites cooling centers in circumstances of extreme heat, which I know the library has at several locations are identified by the Office of Emergency Management as places to where community members can go to mitigate the impacts of extreme heat events and other extreme weather events. To what extent could that be a component of that capital levy?
Well, it most certainly is. Even as we've had our discussions on planning, being green is a big piece of it. And we know, you know, we have buildings that are 120 years old. We have Carnegie buildings, which were built in the late 1890s through even 1920s. Of course, they have all the things you can imagine, old fossil fuel plants, et cetera. But as we go through these levy retrofits that we're doing for seismic improvement, meaning the building will not fall down because it's a brick or masonry building, as we go through there, we're also changing out those fossil fuels. It's a requirement in the city anyway,
yeah,
but it's something we've wanted to do. And it also allows us then to put in more efficient heating and air conditioning systems in a building that didn't have air conditioning, and most certainly in a building that probably could have used a much better heating system during the winter. So as we look at all of our projects and all of our buildings, our goal is to have all of them have air conditioning. We have about 9 buildings right now that don't. By the time we're done with this levy, if all goes well and some of the other efforts we're making, we'll only have about 4 buildings that don't have air conditioning. We'll probably have about 5 buildings that need to have fossil fuel retrofits. So we're making huge strides in those efforts. We're making huge strides in the ADA efforts as well, that accessibility, which is huge for the city, but huge for libraries. We want to make sure that everyone can get into our facilities and to use them fully. So with that, we look at every single building and say, what can we do to make the access here better for people who may have disabilities?
Yeah. Well, Chief Librarian Fay, I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you so much for your service and to your whole team at the Seattle Public Library. It's always a great pleasure when I get to host an update from the library and my committee, and I look forward to continuing to do that in partnership.
Thank you, Councilmember Lewis, and always appreciate your support.
Thank you.